Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is brought to you by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Berry.
And hello, everyone. Nice to be with you again, and thank you so much for dialing us up here on Radio America. It is Home and Family Finance. I am your host, Paul Berry, along with my co-host, Tally Berry. And we'll be talking about a topic that I think is so very legitimate, what is really kind of the foundation of this program. And if you have been a regular listener, you know a couple of weeks ago, we talked about this at length. And we're going to be talking about it throughout the rest of the year because we think, as I said, it is a very foundation. Financial literacy is what drives this program. Financial literacy is important to me, and it is important to you whether you know it or not. And if I can make you understand that it is, guess what? We all win because it is where we're all headed. It will make such a difference in our lives, especially in what you do every day and what your children will do and their grandchildren. We have to become financially literate if we're going to compete in this world, in a global economy, and we have no choice. We must do so. Also today, we also have the very, very special honor of having one of the foremost radio columnists, if you will, and she's just great. Janet Bodner, don't often get her. She's editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Sometimes we have the associate editors, but not the real deal. Well, today we got the real deal, and she's going to be talking about the three types of insurance to protect your college student. You ever think about that? You send them away from home, and are they protected properly? Well, she will tell us what you should know, and she'll list out these various policies and why you need them for your youngster wherever they may be attending college. Good stuff. But we're going to begin now with what we talked about to you. On July 9th, if you were listening, the week of that, we brought to you the results of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. It released its first ever PISA, which stands for Program for International Student Assessment. They did a research focused on financial literacy. Tally, you and I had the pleasure of being at that conference. I think some of the people in attendance was the Secretary of Education, Arne right. Duncan, also the head of John Rogers, head of the President's Advisory on Financial Literacy. But it kind of, I thought, harnessed and also showed the importance of financial literacy and how it's moving up. But maybe you can sum up for us, what your impressions of what we learned that day.
Yeah, well, it was the first study of its type. We know how important financial literacy is, but what we didn't know was how prevalent financial literacy is in this country and around the world. What PISA is, the Program for International Student Assessment, is every three-year test, a triennial test, that usually studies mathematics, science, and reading mm-hmm. across countries so we can see what teaching techniques are working, which countries are leading the way. But this year, or in 2012, the last year they have data for, they added financial literacy for the first time. Mm-hmm. So we now, in 2014, with the release of the data, have the first opportunity to assess different countries' prospects in financial literacy and their progress in financial literacy.
So how did they do that? In other words, they tested a certain grade level or a certain age against how many countries? How did that work? What did they do?
Right. Well, they have they test 15-year-olds in all these different countries. And for financial literacy, they started small. They started with 18 countries, 13 of which are in OECD and 5 of which are just cooperating partner countries.
Sure, sure.
One of which is Shanghai in China. And they actually did the best. But the tests, so they do different level questions. They have questions that you should get if you're at the base level of financial literacy. They have questions that are a bit harder. And finally, they have questions that you're only going to be able to answer if you're really competent mm-hmm. in financial literacy mm-hmm. and
these
logical thinking.
These were 15-year-olds only. That's who they were.
15-year-olds.
Okay, and
mm-hmm.
they were comparing 15-year-olds in some 18 countries against each other. Is that basically?
Exactly.
Wow. And Shanghai, you said, was the top. But we must have been right under them, right next to them.
Yep. You'd hope we would be right under them. But if you've been following the PISA results, we've been lagging behind in mathematics. We're about average in reading and science. And in financial literacy, it was no different.
Wow.
We are maybe below average in the OECD countries, right around average. and about average among the 18 countries that took
below
the test.
Below average. Bones, we are the number one country, the industrial nation in the world. How is it that we can be number one in that? Resources, we think in education, everything else, and we are not at the top. We are in below average in the middle of the pack.
Yeah, there are a few different explanations. The Arne Duncan, who we mentioned earlier, the Secretary of Education, he called it a picture of educational stagnation. That
wow.
was the term he used.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Van Runkel of the National Education Association said it's possibly because of a failure to address poverty and that maybe our results are brought down by socioeconomic differences in the test takers.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Tali. Of the nations, there are 18 nations involved, right? The strata of poverty up and down the scale from the top money makers to the it's got to be the
right.
same. I mean, they didn't test just the best in Shanghai, and
right.
golly knows there are levels of poverty there. So is that an excuse? It sounds more like an excuse than a result.
Well, we can hope it's an excuse because Shanghai is not China, and perhaps if you test rural China, you get different results. But certainly in the U.S., it made a difference. Among students who had bank accounts,
yeah.
the results were much better. And I believe 32% of students in the lowest socioeconomic quartile have bank accounts in the U.S. About 70% in the highest quartile do. So we saw those differences across countries, and that's really what's going to be interesting, is we have a chance to see whether it is the socioeconomics of it making the difference.
And if it, and by understanding that, if it eliminates an excuse and gets us to what we really need to know are the reasons for these things, we can start to doing something about it.
Exactly.
All right. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry, your host, and my co-host is Tali Berry. Yeah, the name is the same because he's my son, graduate of UNC, University of North Carolina, and is in the middle of how this is going to affect people. When we come back, we'll talk more about this very important subject and how you can. It's a call to action for you, too. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. We'll be right back.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
Test results that can have a profound impact on all of us if we use them to our advantage. We're talking today about the results of a test of a data that's come in and was released at George Washington University on July 9th. It was the PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment, the results from that dealing with financial literacy. And as Tali and I attended this thing, we were struck with the fact that we may be number one in a lot of areas, but we're not number one when it comes to how we're teaching our children what they need to know. Now, we can talk about Shanghai, which is at the very top. We can talk about Colombia, which is at the very bottom. But let's talk about the United States, which is squarely in the middle. And Tali, you have some stats on that. Serve it up, please.
Yeah, because of the vagaries of test taking and probability, we can't nail it down, but we're somewhere between 8th and 12th of the 18 countries that took the test.
Wow. 8th
yeah.
and 12th.
8th and 12th. And it may have something to do with the differing standards in the U.S.
Okay.
Here at home, there are 19 states that require a course in personal finance.
19 of the 50.
Mm-hmm. Between kindergarten and 12th grade, 19 of the 50 states.
Say it another way, Tali. The others don't require anything.
Yep, 31 states who don't require a course in personal finance. Now,
wait a minute. You know what? We play educational roulette, if you will. We give our kids a little science because they might become a doctor. We give them
right.
Social studies, a little of everything because we don't know what they're going to be when they grow up. But the one thing that we know they're going to be, the one thing every one of us is going to be is a consumer.
Right.
You know, and yet 31 states don't require that we learn very much about balancing a checkbook or anything else.
Right. And that's one of the points that was forefront at the conference. I think Dr. Andreas Schleicher, who presented the data,
yeah.
suggested that we still teach things like trigonometry. when very few of our students are going to grow up to be farmers who need to know how to measure their fields.
But we still teach it.
Exactly.
I think we fall in love with the name of it, something that's difficult supposedly. And so but that's not how you measure knowledge. That's not practical in terms of being able to, as I say, balance a checkbook or go to the store and figure out whether it's a deal or not.
Right. And, it's useful for some. If you go into engineering, it's useful. But like you said, we know everyone will be going into consuming.
Yeah, everybody. Mm-hmm. That's what we are, folks. And if you are listening out there, everybody that's listening, if you've never been ripped off in the marketplace, stand up now, would you? I don't hear a chair shuffling because, nobody can stand up because we all get ripped off. And we get ripped off, Tali, because we don't have the basic knowledge. These are stats. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm stunned.
Right. Yeah. Well, fortunately, there are standards for economics between kindergarten and 12th grade in each state. But like I said, not in personal finance. 24 states require a high school course in economics to be offered. So in the other 26 states, economics is offered before high school and not necessarily offered at that level. But the strange thing, 89% of Americans, almost 9 in 10 Americans, believe financial education should be taught in schools. That's according to a study done by the National Financial Capability.
So 9 out of 10 people say, we should be teaching it.
Exactly.
And yet we're not.
Right.
How is that possible? How is it that my son or daughter is in school, I think they should learn this, and yet they're not learning it. And I think it may be because we're not paying close enough attention to demand that they learn financial literacy.
That may be it. One of the big recommendations from the conference was that we need to raise our voices as parents, as students, as consumers, tell our congresspeople what we want, tell our lawmakers that we need to have financial literacy in schools. It also may be because there's a difficulty in implementing financial literacy standards. In some of the countries they studied, it may not be taught as financial literacy. They just have mathematical, logical capabilities beyond our students, and that translates to financial literacy ability.
And I think the other thing we got to think about, too, who's doing the teaching?
Mm-hmm.
The teachers don't know this.
Right.
They haven't been taught. So who's going to teach the teachers, and which teachers are going to teach us?
Right. Yeah, exactly. In Arkansas, when they instituted this program, one of the people putting it in place said, teachers who have a social studies certification feel great comfort teaching history and geography, but they don't feel confident teaching economics.
They don't know it.
Right.
If I didn't learn it, I know that in your school you did. You have to go to a school where that was part of the curriculum.
Right.
This is Tali Berry. I'm my co-host today. I'm Paul Berry. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. Folks, I hope you can see this as what it is. It's a call to action. That's why we're doing this. I'm calling you to do what you should do. We can make a difference. When we come back, we'll talk about what you can do, and you know now why you should do it. Home and Family Finance, we'll be right back. If you're a regular listener to Home and Family Finance, you know that we always base everything we do on financial literacy. All of our topics are based on that. We don't play a lot of music. We don't do that kind of thing. But what we do here is to bring to you what we think are the facts about issues and the answers to those issues that affect your home, your family, and your finances. And here on Radio America, I'm very pleased to tell you that our program sponsor is the Defense Credit Union Council and the Credit Union National Association. And we thank them for their continued support of this program dedicated to making all of us smarter consumers. And if there's a topic or subject that you want to discuss, please write to me here, Paul Berry at Radio America, 1100 North Glebe Road, Suite 900, Arlington, Virginia, 22201, or you may contact me on my website at www.paulberry.com. And the Defense Credit Union Council, I want you to know, and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of military saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our servicemen and women. Military Saves is a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, support, and encourage military families to save money, reduce debt, and build wealth. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves. Set a goal. Make a plan. Save automatically. Go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. Good news for our military and, of course, for all of us out there, Tally. Saving is so vitally important. You ought to be saving something every day. Pay yourself first. You've heard that before. And in so doing, you learn the progression from saving to investments to so-and-so as it continues. And that's what's missing today, because we don't teach in our schools anything even remotely interesting or involved about financial literacy. 30-some-odd states don't require anything. And those that do it at a level, I think it's safe to say that is at best at the freshman level.
Right. Well, in America, we've got 18% of our students who don't reach the baseline level. If you don't reach the baseline level, you're having trouble distinguishing between wants and needs. You're having trouble thinking about the fact that your financial decisions today can have an impact even in the near future.
Wait a minute. Almost one in five. They don't have the basic knowledge coming out of school to do the basic things that would make them effective consumers.
Right. Yeah. And that's the basic level. So that is, to put it in terms of literacy instead of financial literacy, you can't read financially. This is like being financially illiterate.
Illiterate. Well, folks, the call to action here, I can talk and you may say I do it till I'm blue in the face about the importance of financial literacy. But I think this puts it in perspective. What do we expect from our children? How do we compete globally, Tally? How do we then go into a world now which is different than my world? My son is considerably younger. He's got to compete against people not only in this country but around the world. How do we compete if we don't have the financial sense or the understanding of even how our system works?
Well, yeah, it's difficult. It's going to be really difficult going forward. But there are a couple warriors out there on our side. There's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, led by Richard Cordray, who is speaking at the conference. And they're doing several things right now. There are five steps to move forward on financial literacy. I'll read those for you.
Okay.
First, introduce key financial education concepts early. So you should be starting at kindergarten with really useful day-to-day information, right? Second, include on standardized tests personal financial management questions. We've seen with the proliferation of the SAT industry how important those tests are to parents and to students. If financial literacy is on there, that's going to be studied. Three, provide opportunities K through 12 for hands-on learning. So put money in the hands of students, put stocks in the hands of students, let them participate in the things they'll be doing when they graduate. Four, create opportunities and incentives for teachers. So that you want the teachers to have advanced training in these so they can pass on advanced knowledge to the students. And five, encourage parents and guardians to discuss with their kids. So if you're a parent or if you're a kid, you need to start having these conversations. That's something you can do right now.
So don't say to me or to Tally that you don't know what you can do. The call to action is right there, folks. There are things that you have to go to your school and demand what you just heard. Those five things, and participate. And if you do, we can make this a better place for all of us to live in with some financial knowledge. Okay, we got to turn to other topics. Tally's going to sit in when we talk about what your kid needs if they go to college to protect them from in terms of insurance. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry.
Helping you be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
And we say welcome back to Janet Bodner, who's editor, Kiplinger's Personal Finance. We're always delighted to have one of the editors on from Kiplinger News. Usually they're associate editors or editors of this or that. But this is, quote unquote, folks, the editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. And as you know, Janet Bodner is, she's just well known in so many great things when it comes to understanding answers to the things that affect our home, our family, and our finances. Janet, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thanks for the intro, Paul.
Well, you deserve that and even more. Joining us today, again, will be my son, Tally Berry, who is not so many years out of college, a couple of years out of college, so I think he'll bring that perspective as we talk about the three types of insurance to protect your college student. And I found it an interesting topic because I think we have no, as parents, we have no hesitancy to make sure that they have the proper insurance when they're in the house with us and all that. But then when they leave, I'm not sure, Janet, that people think about the insurance issue, do they?
Probably absolutely not, I would say.
Yeah.
Really, because, I mean, you know, you're worried about paying the tuition bill and, you know, room and board and that sort of thing. And either you don't think about it at all or, you know, subconsciously you're thinking, well, everything stays the same, you know, as far as of insurance. You know,
right,
so if
right.
if they're covered now, they're going to be covered when they go away. So you just don't even, it's not something that rises to the top of your consciousness.
But I suspect that some of these insurances may have some restriction one way or the other once you're out of the house itself, once you're physically out of the house.
Right. And sometimes it's a not so good thing, and sometimes it can be a good thing if the kids are out of the house. So it's really important for you to know one way or the other, both for the coverage of the kids and also for your own pocketbook.
Well, I know that there are, in this instance, we're talking about three types of insurance. And so let's begin with what I consider one of the most important, health insurance. I mean, what do we do here? And is this going to break the bank?
Well, generally speaking, your children are going to be covered by your health insurance policy when they go off to college and up until the age of 26. So even when they're out of college or perhaps when they're still in grad school, they can be covered by your policy. So that's one rule that's general in nature. So that's kind of the good news. Now, here's the bad news. Perhaps what you need to do is check with your policy to see what its requirement is as far as getting treatment within a network. Because let's say your child is going to school several hundred miles away. Well, are they going to be covered if they seek coverage or treatment which would be considered out of network?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important thing for you to figure out or ask about from your current insurer. And then depending on what the response is, you may have to take some other steps to make sure that your child is covered.
And I think the important part here is to suggest that you can't just simply say, I'll play health roulette here, health insurance roulette.
Right.
You've got to be covered because, and Tally, I know it when you were away at UNC, a couple of times either you were sick or, whatever it was, you know, so you have to have the coverage.
It's great being at home. You know, you're covered. You've got chicken soup and ginger ale for mom. But it's especially important to have that kind of serious protection when you're away.
Absolutely. Janet, is it something? What's a better way to do this? Should I extend my coverage for them, or should they buy their own, or at least should they buy additional coverage for them?
Well, that is the second step after once you have contacted your own health insurer to find out what the situation is. Now, it may be that, you know, your child would continue to be covered either because they're not going so far away, they would still be considered in-network or have access to in-network care, or they would cover a college student who is, you know, far from home. It depends on the answer from your health insurer. Now, if the health insurer answer is yes, the child is covered, hey, you're golden. If the answer is no, then you got to look into some other things. One option might be buying a student health insurance policy from the university. And now that used to be not such a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Very often it was very expensive and the coverage wasn't all that great. But again, policies have changed and it's worth looking into. And you know, even if, for example, it has very basic coverage, so it covers the campus clinic or it covers an affiliated nearby hospital, that can be a good supplement to your policy if your policy has little or no in-network coverage that's mm-hmm. near the college. So it's worth looking at the college's policy, which may be a better deal than it has been in the past.
Well, and then of course, shadowing all of this huge shadow kind of creeps over all of this when we talk about health insurance, is the so-called Obamacare or affordable
right.
health care. How does that impact or play in this, if it does at all?
Well, that is another alternative that your student would have, to buy an individual policy through the local health insurance exchange, depending on the state in which they are located. You can also, you don't have to necessarily go through an exchange. You can go through an independent health insurance agent,
okay.
which can, you know, also sell you a policy. So you can go around the exchanges. As you know, the exchanges have been very, very spotty mm-hmm. state to state, mm-hmm. To say the least. Some states, you know, they didn't work at all. Some states, they functioned very well. So it kind of depends on where your student is going to be. One thing that you have to think about is that students, now, as long as your student is still a dependent for tax purposes with mm-hmm. you on your exchange, then he's not going to qualify for any subsidies. There won't be any premium subsidies involved.
Okay.
So he'll be paying whatever the full freight is for someone of his age and depending on the type of policy that he would choose.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're talking with Janet Bodner. Janet, if somebody wants more information on health insurance, how can they contact you or Kiplinger?
Oh, well, you can go to kiplinger.com, our website, www.kiplinger.com, and you can find lots more information on this particular story. It also appeared in the August issue of our magazine, which is on newsstands, so that can be very helpful. Plus, on our website, we have additional information on
okay.
the subject.
We'll be right back. Stay with us, folks.
We want you to be a part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Or maybe just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
And Tally Berry is joining us, a not too long ago college student, as we talk about the three types of insurance to protect your college student, with none other than Janet Bodner, the editor of Kiplinger magazine, Kiplinger.com. You know, Janet, I'm pleased that we're talking about this, because sometimes we don't think about this until it's too late, until something happens. But Tali, I think in your case, you had the health insurance did work for you. How did it work? Was it
right? Yeah, I had a couple issues: broken foot. I think I had a back problem coming out of high school football, but. I believe I was covered under our family umbrella, so
yeah.
I didn't have to deal with that problem so much. I did, you know, I always worried, though, that besides health, I was living in a dorm, and I took guitars, I took iPhone, computer, everything. I always heard you were covered under your parents' plan if you were living in a dorm, but not necessarily off campus. Is that right, Janet?
Yes and no. Actually, it's a very good question. You are covered as long as you're living in an on-campus dorm. Your parents' homeowner's insurance usually will provide coverage. But now here's the kicker. Liability limits will be the same. So, you know, if some horrible thing happens in your room, I guess, you would be covered.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be usually a 10% limit on possessions coverage, because the items are not in your home. So if somebody breaks their leg in your room and maybe there's some liability involved, you're probably going to be covered. But if your guitar gets stolen or your laptop gets trashed, or, you know, you spill beer on the laptop in some wild, you know, Saturday night party,
oh, yeah. Okay.
The possessions limit, there's a limitation on that coverage, and it's 10% of what your coverage limit is. So again, it bears checking to see exactly how much do you have, how much coverage do you have on possessions. Take 10% of that and then figure out, okay, is this going to be enough to cover something that happens in the dorm room?
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Does that change when you move out of a dorm, if you're living in your own place?
Yeah, it does. And actually, I should add, and I should have added before, if you find that there's not enough coverage, that the 10% limit doesn't cover everything, you can buy additional coverage for PCs, tablets, and other pricey items. And it doesn't cost a lot. It costs about $50 to $100 a year. So again, you know, if the kids have a lot of expensive electronic equipment and you can't trust those college kids when they go, you might want to get that kind of a rider. Now, to address your second question, yeah, it does change if you move off campus. Because in that case, you may actually need to buy a basic renter's policy. This is something I'm sure nobody ever thinks of. Speak to your point initially, Paul. Nobody thinks about this. But, you know, the homeowner's policy is not going to kick in if your child moves off campus.
Okay, and that's important to know. And the other thing I wondered about is this. Okay, you know, whatever our relationship was, and it's good or it may not be, but my kid now moves to an off-campus dorm despite I'm off-campus site despite my objections. So I decide, I decide that I'm going to buy some health. I'm going to buy some renter's insurance. Can I buy that insurance? Can I insure him without his approval?
I think you can, and it doesn't, again, it's not a huge amount of money as far as the premium is concerned. One of the benchmarks that we use in Kiplinger's, which is in the August issue of the magazine, Kiplinger's Personal Finance, and also in the story that appears at Kiplinger.com, one of the benchmarks we use is that for $15,000 worth of property coverage and $500,000 worth of liability coverage, that would cost $125 to $150 a year.
Jeepers, that's not expensive at all.
No, it is not. And remember this, too. Unrelated roommates may need separate policies. So if you're in there with a bunch of guys, you know, one policy is not necessarily going to cover everything. You know, so you may want to look into that as well.
Have I got to cover every one of those little bad boys in that room? I don't want to do that.
I don't think you want to do that.
No, but what you're saying, I think, is know what your limit, what the limits are, and what's covered and what isn't.
That's right, and that's really critical. And what you initially said, think of these things because nobody ever thinks of this stuff. You know, you don't really, you know, you think about outfitting your kid if they're going off to college or if they're going to rent an off-campus apartment. Then you think about signing the lease, you know, and who's liable if certain things happen and that sort of thing. But you don't think, oh, my gosh, you know, what if they're broken into or, you know, what if they have some wild and crazy party and somebody does break a leg? Then what happens, you know? So I think that, you know, you really have to think about those things.
Now, do you think schools should do a better job educating parents and students when they get to school about additional insurance costs and the risks? Or does this tie more into the financial literacy and you should know this yourself?
Oh, yeah. You know, that is an excellent question because financial literacy in general is such an important issue. And going off to college, I mean, people focus on things like student loans and what kids and parents need to know about student loans and that sort of thing. But this is really important, I think. And some schools do. I do a lot in the financial literacy space, so I know that there are colleges that more and more offer financial education programs to their students. I mean, I know that, heck, I had three kids who went through college, and I went to three parent days, and nobody raised these issues.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it really wasn't something that came up. So I think that if they have an intro program for students that, you know, has to do with college finances, and certainly the programs they always have for parents, it really is something that they ought to be covering.
You know, and topic, it occurs to me that what we ought to be doing as parents is before our kids walk out of the house going to college, we ought to sit down and have these conversations with them.
Right.
You know, doesn't it make sense to say, look, maybe I haven't told you everything. We have insurance. Here's what it is. If you do this, this is what it's going to happen. If you do that, this is what. And I apologize to tell you, I don't think I ever had that conversation with you because, Janet, I didn't think about it. But I knew, you know, I knew we had coverage. And then I had to try to figure, I guess, I wonder if the coverage covers, you know. So when we come back, we'll talk more about that because I think we have to have these kind of conversations. I think it would have made a difference with you, Tally, right? Yeah. Okay. We're talking with Janet Bodner from Kiplinger. When we come back, we're going to go into the last coverage, that's car insurance, and we may fold back and answer some other questions on these other two. You're listening to Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, along with my co-host, Tally Berry. The This is Paul Berry, along with Tally Berry, your host for today's program, as we talk with Janet Bodner, editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. And our topic is the three types of insurance to protect your college student. You didn't think about that, did you? And now Johnny or Sue are heading off to college, and you say, doggone it, I didn't think about the insurance. And guess what they're taking? Janet, they're taking my car. Well, it's their car, but I'm paying for the insurance, and I paid for the car, and I repair it. So it's kind of like my car, but they're taking it off to school. Am I going to be sorry here, Janet?
You really want the easy answer? The easy answer is yes, you're going to be sorry. Don't do it. At least if they're a freshman. Now, maybe if they're an upperclassman and they have had some experience and, you know, they're more mature, then yeah, maybe. But as freshmen, don't do it. And there are just so many reasons. And one of which is, of course, the insurance angle, which is what you're talking about today. Yeah. If your son or daughter takes a car with him or her, your premiums could go up, or possibly they could go down, depending on where she's moving. But there are other things involved here, and that is parking. You're going to have to pay for parking on campus. If you're going to have to then pay for parking tickets, we hear this all the time at Kiplinger. It's one of those things that you really never think about before you take the car away. But, you know, kids don't pay attention to where they're parking, or they're going to get really sucked. I know my son was a grad student at the University of Maryland, and the parking tickets there were incredible, incredibly high, and they were on you immediately because, of course, this was a source of revenue for the school.
And the kids don't pay the parking tickets.
No, they don't. Yeah. They just ignore them, you know, until they build up. And so you've got, the parking pass that you got to pay for. There's the parking tickets when they don't listen to the parking pass or abide by it, you know. Plus, there's all the maintenance and all the rest of it. So I really think that you should think twice, more than twice, about having the kids go off with their own car.
Yeah, Tally, you could jump in here anytime. You know, you got very quiet when he started talking about parking tickets and insurance. Tally, remember those days, right?
I do, yeah.
See?
When I moved off campus, it was great. I needed to have a car. You know, I was all over the place. But, yeah, in the dorms, absolutely a bad idea. I agree. Yeah. And I think even most of the kids who had cars there knew it was a hassle by the end of their freshman years.
Yeah, and I think you're right. We did not allow the children to take the cars in their freshman year because they were still finding out who they were on college campuses, you know.
Exactly.
So after the sophomore year, that might be a bit. I think junior, senior. Well, what do you think, Tally? When did you need your car?
I think it's mostly just where you're living. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was on campus for 2 years, and then I was in a house with about 40 guys. I won't tell you exactly what was going on there, but we. I had a car there because we had a parking lot, so that was easy.
Yeah.
Off campus.
Yeah, that makes a difference.
Yeah, and you know, that's an interesting point. I know it's off car insurance, but when you have a car on campus, you have a Tally, verify this. They know you've got the car, so who gets asked to do driving? I mean, it is an additional responsibility.
Yeah, it sure is. Right? Yeah, it can be a pain. You're always on the line. You get called in the middle of the night because somebody got stuck at the beach or something.
Yeah. Then they want you to come.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'll pay you back, right? I love that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, Janet, guess who gets the call? Dad, I'm a little short this week.
That's right. You know. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there's another thing that parents may not realize, and that is if your child moves to college more than 100 miles away from home and does not take a car with him, your premiums could actually drop significantly, as much as 30 or 40%, because your child, and you know that teenage kids are high-risk kids, is no longer on the day-to-day policy. And the student will still be covered when he or she comes home for a vacation, you know, or semester break or whatever, and drives your car.
Yeah.
So you may actually get a break on your policy.
And also, before we run out of time, is if they maintain good grades, that does factor in as well, doesn't it?
Exactly. A B average or better could qualify for a good student discount of 5% to 15%. So that makes a difference, too, obviously.
It sure does. So, folks, read up and find out what you need to know about car insurance and talk with your kid about that before they leave. And congratulations that they're going off to college, but you got to be prepared. Janet, you're always prepared. You always do such a great job with us. Thanks for taking time to join us here on Home and Family Finance.
Well, my pleasure, as usual, and it was a pleasure meeting Callie, too.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel the same way about him, but I'm prejudiced, okay? Come back and see us again soon, would you?
Sure.
All right. Janet Bodner, editor Kiplinger Magazine, just great to have her on the program. It's great to have you with us, too, folks. We really enjoy it. Tali, thank you for joining in and for upping the discussion and taking us into some personal experiences. We'll be back the same time next week. We hope you'll join us here on Home and Family Finance. It's always a pleasure. Al Peterson, our engineer, thanks for making this happen. We'll see you next week, folks.